Rethinking Walking, hosted by Andrew Stuck from Rethinking Cities and the Museum of Walking. Talking Walking brings you interviews with people from the world of walking, artists, activists, professionals, and those of us who have a passion for just taking a walk. Ella Parry-Davies, a postdoctoral researcher at the Royal Central School of Speech and Drama, has been facilitating HomemakersSounds.org, a collection of sound walks made with Filipino domestic and care workers employed behind closed doors in the Lebanon and the UK. In this interview, the ambiguity, complexity and unfairness of government immigration policies discussed, as well as how recording and co-editing sound walks develops an intimacy rarely found in ethnographic research. Can you just tell me a little bit about being awarded as a New Generation Thinker?
Okay, so the New Generation Thinker programme is run by the BBC with the Arts and Humanities Research Council. And they award this kind of interesting-sounding title, New Generation Thinker, to 10 academics, researchers every year. And what it means is that you can kind of make a number of broadcasts with BBC Radio 3, which is really exciting because, obviously, as somebody working with sound, I was, you know, it was a great opportunity to do some radio work, which was something that I hadn't done before.
Why would you qualify to be?
Well, you have to be at the kind of start of your career as an academic or kind of recently come out of a PhD. I think to an extent you have to be working with ideas that are interesting to people beyond academics. They do put this emphasis on thinking, which in my case is definitely not a kind of purely conceptual or intellectual thing. I do think, and I think about the way that I think and the methods that I'm using and that kind of thing, but a lot of the work that I do is very embodied, I suppose. You know, it's about walking and spending time with people, and it's nice to think also that within that title, New Generation Thinker, there's quite a lot of space for making.
Listeners will be immediately picking up the fact that you mentioned that you've been working with sound. So let's explore that. Was that something that you started doing before you thought about the research project? And how are you using it in your research?
I'm making sound walks, and I started out thinking about domestic work and the experiences of migrant domestic workers. And so sound and sound walking presented itself, I suppose, as the most direct way I could think of for engaging migrant domestic workers in a process of collaborative research. So the way that that works is that I would invite somebody, usually the people I work with are women, and lots of them are from the Philippines, and I would invite one of these women to take me to a place that has a particular significance for her or is memorable for some reason. Sometimes they're sites of activism and kind of community action or community meaning. Sometimes they're very personal, for example, places where people have escaped from abusive employers.
When we're talking about abusive employers, we're talking about here in England.
In the UK, there's a tied visa system in place, which was implemented by the Conservative government in 2012. And that means that migrant domestic workers can't change employers without putting their visa at risk or without becoming undocumented. What that means then for them is that it becomes kind of almost impossible, really, to negotiate with your employers. So one of the women that I've worked with, she made a sound walk called Let the People Know, Let Them Feel. She worked 12 hours a day, 5 days a week, for a family. That family, her visa is tied to that family. They're her employers. She also takes on extra work, one or two nights a week, and she does work on Saturday. So she's really kind of got very, very, very limited time off, because she doesn't make the minimum wage from that family. And she can't negotiate with them. She can't change employers. She can't go on strike. She can't withdraw her labour because her visa is tied to them. And that's the system that we have legally in the UK.
Now you're working with particular care workers who come from particular regions of the world. So can you explain why those, and what sort of numbers of people are there who are working in that kind of work?
So I mainly work with Filipino women. when I was based in the region in Southeast Asia during my PhD, and formed some really strong and significant connections for me with academics and artists there, and did a visiting scholarship at De La Salle University just before I started this project, so in 2018. So there was a kind of a basis, some knowledge or understanding, and also a language basis there, which meant that I'm working with majority Filipino women, not because I want to make any kind of generalizations about Filipino culture or shared experiences, but because it gives me an understanding of where people are coming from and what the discourses and economic and political systems around migration are that shapes their experience even while they're abroad. So currently 5,000 people are leaving the Philippines every single day to find work abroad. I think it's the third top remittance receiving nation in the world. Out-migration or labour migration has been a really kind of institutionalised part of life for many families for generations now, since kind of the Marcos dictatorship. And so it's really important to me to kind of understand the context that people are coming from and how they identify as migrants, the different ways they identify as labour migrants, because of the discourses and narratives that are shaped by the Philippine state.
Approximately how many Philippine women or men, is it men and women or just women, working in London, say?
I think there are about 300,000 Filipinos working in the UK at the moment. And this surprises a lot of people. After British and Indian nationals, they're the third highest national group employed by the NHS. And yet I think they're not a very visible community, partly because many Filipinos in the UK work in care or domestic work. Not all of them at all, but many. And those are quite privatised. Oh, in the words of one of the women I work with, she works behind closed doors. And that's the case for domestic workers. It's a fact of life for domestic workers that you're not working in the street, you're not working in public places, you're working behind the doors of the employing family. And so they can be a very kind of invisible community and very marginalised in that sense.
Have they taken you to places which they go to on their very limited time off? Or is it places they go, well, they are doing their work?
It's definitely them taking me, and they choose those places for different reasons. At least one of them has taken me to a site of escape from employers, sorry. So one of those was in Hyde Park. A woman I worked with escaped there, and she now goes back to Hyde Park to make contact with other Filipino domestic workers and help them escape if they need to from abusive employment situations. So one of the women actually took me to Holland Park. She was working for employers in Qatar who brought her to London with them on holiday, and they used to go to Holland Park a lot, and partly it was because it was a site associated with those memories, but partly she wanted to see them. She wanted to bump into them. And in her words, to prove to them that she's not nothing. And that's the title of the sound walk, Not Nothing. And we didn't happen to bump into her employers that day. But I think if we had, it would have been a very, very different experience. And she really gave me no warning about this at all. So there's a lot of contingency, I suppose, or unpredictability about where people choose to take me. And I'm kind of in their hands in that sense.
You've obviously had to establish a considerable amount of trust with these people, mm-hmm. one. And two, how do you find these people, or how do they find you?
I started out by approaching organisations, the Voice of Domestic Workers, for example. Community leaders in those groups were able to say, for example, I don't think that this person's ready to have a conversation with you. And so they kind of facilitated that in a safe way, in a structured way, in an ethical way, really.
When you're talking to the domestic workers, because you're recording their stories, is this telling the stories something that you think is attractive to them because they have a story to tell and they haven't had the opportunity to tell the story?
Yeah. I think people get involved in the project for different reasons, and some that I hadn't really clearly foreseen. So they kind of co-opt it to their own ends to an extent. Some of them have really, really clear activist messages, and they say, here's a message for the UK government. I'm speaking to the UK government really, really explicitly in the sound walks. One of the sound walks is called Because I Know Somebody Is Listening. It's about a woman, she's 55, she's been a domestic worker for 35 years in Lebanon. She plays guitar in her church band, and she's lesbian. And the church is actively homophobic. And so the sound walk's about her kind of negotiating her faith and her passion for playing the guitar and her kind of circumstances as a domestic worker in Lebanon with her homosexuality. She says in the sound walk, I feel lighter because I know somebody's listening to my story. And I think that kind of almost therapeutic element was something that I hadn't really foreseen. But something we haven't talked about yet is that the women also co-edit the sound walk.
I was going to ask, how much further are they involved in the production?
Actually, I always start with the question, why are we here? And that's the only question that I know I'm going to ask. So the rest of the conversation is kind of directed by them. Then we work together to edit the recording. Some of the women have spent up to 14 hours editing the recording with me. That's an important part of why I wanted to work with sound as well, is that it offers this kind of collaborative structure. So there's different kind of levels of autonomy and collaboration there. That's a really key part of it. Sound editing is really slow, as you know, and you might spend 14 hours together and end up with a sound walk of 14 minutes. So it's kind of a very, very considered process of deciding how people want to represent themselves or what stories they want to tell, how they want to tell the stories. And I think in some cases, when we've reflected on that process, one woman in particular said to me, I didn't realise how, in her words, systematic the process of editing was and how it could change your story. And she'd spoken to other journalists and researchers in the past. She said, okay, thank you, this is a really transparent process, and I hadn't realised how much you could twist the story through how you edit it.
Okay, so you have these stories now, you've had them recorded and co-edited and co-produced. You have them on a website. Well, what's the website again that people can reach and listen to these?
It's homemakersounds.org.
Now, are the stories themselves geolocated? How does it function?
Each sound file comes with kind of an instruction and a map. So it might be just go for a walk in Holland Park, or it might be retrace the march of a protest, like a migrant worker rights protest, for example. Some of them are in London, some of them are in Beirut, where I did a lot of my PhD work.
So you've been working with Filipinos in Beirut?
Yeah.
And Filipinos in London?
Yeah.
And Filipinos, you're about to go to the Philippines,
yeah,
again?
Yeah.
To work with Filipinos in Philippines?
In the Philippines, yeah. So people who've returned and are kind of remaking homes that they've left behind, sometimes for decades, or people who are considering going abroad to work.
Okay, so that's going to be very intriguing. That's a completely different side.
Yeah.
And, you know, dare I be awkward and ask, I mean, what's the output of all this research?
So the website's there. The website's important that it's there, it's open access, people can access it, the women can access it and share the links and that kind of thing. I'm also writing a book because I'm an academic and that's what we do. It's really nice to have that kind of long-form space to reflect on all this process and what I've learned from it. But I think one of the really important things that I've learned from it is that, so the website's called, it's homemakersounds.org, and it's called Homemakers because the women I work with work and often live in other people's homes. They're away from home to the extent that they're in processes of migration. But as migrants, I think that they are experts in creating a sense of home, not through the spaces where they live, but the spaces where they spend their time off, or places where they create kind of memorable connections to, or community connections to. And that's really where the idea of sound walks came from to begin with. It came from the question, if your home is also where you work, how do you create a sense of home through your relationships to public spaces? Can you take me to those spaces? Can we talk about them? Can you show me how that happens rather than just kind of coming to my office and having an interview about it? Can you show me how that works? That's where the idea of the sound walks came from.
So I listened to, I have to say, it was rather heartbreaking and gut-wrenching, and I thought, well, I'm not sure I'm going to listen to more than one of these, you know, because I thought, oh, you know, this was quite... It was about the woman who says how long she's missed her children for. She hasn't seen
four years. Of all the soundworks, that's maybe the most emotive.
OK, so, you know, what slightly caught me out was that you're an academic at the Royal Central School of Speech and Drama, and I thought, well, that's OK, I could work it out. Maybe that's got something to do with the sound walks. But it's actually because a lot of your work is described as performative and embodied. Would you like to explain a little bit about what that actually means?
So I'm definitely from a theatre and performance background. And although that in my PhD, for example, that took the form of kind of... I was writing rather than making. I was writing about other people's performances. Now that I'm at Central, which is it's a drama school, it's a practice-based institution, it's really nice to be surrounded by colleagues who think about sound because they know about miking up actors in a theatre, or because, you know, they have really, really concrete and tactile and, embodied, I suppose, experiences and perspectives on these questions. I do think of sound walks as definitely a performance practice, if not a theatrical one. And obviously, I'm not the first person to work with this form. It's quite canonical in performance studies: headphone theatre, sound walking, walking art. For me, it has been a practice, but it's also been a method of research.
Now that you've been using sound walks as part of your research, is that something that you might be doing in the future? Do you see something beyond the work that you're doing already, or are you so, at the moment, so immersed in what you're doing, especially if you're writing a book? Where does the future take Ella Parry-Davis?
So I'm halfway through a 3-year fellowship at the moment.
Now you yourself have learnt to make sound walk, do you feel that you'd like to make more creative work that way? I mean, do you think it's a medium that you'd like to work more with?
As I said, I was very new to that form. It was a form that came out of the research questions rather than something that I was kind of already, you know, expert in or anything like that. It's a lovely form, and it's interesting now to be on the other side of the tape recorder because I'm usually in your position. In the work that I've been doing, it's lovely because there's something very intimate about it. It's not face-to-face, it's side-by-side, and there's a kind of a relaxed intimacy about that, I think. And people can really open up in a way that's not... So, OK, let me come back on that. That idea of intimacy, I think, is definitely there. Having said that, I'm not trying to pretend that in walking kind of in the footsteps of somebody and revisiting that place and listening to their voice, you're in their shoes. There are limitations, I think, and it's important to be aware of those. And I've learnt that very much from a performance background, really, which is very concerned with, you know, and has very critical approaches to kind of identification or empathy, putting yourself in the shoes of somebody. And I think walking side by side, yeah, has been a very close and a very intimate, I keep coming back to that word, I suppose, an intimate kind of form of talking to somebody.
No, because what I was going to say is, from my experience, I've developed a full sense of intimacy almost, because I'm now going to go and edit this work. I'm going to listen to your voice over and over again, you know? I almost fall into the trap where I think, well, Ella now knows me better than she actually does, and I know her better, and there's more... I can be more, jokey, flippant, whatever, with her than I should be. I know that sounds bonkers, but I actually have that.
No, I know exactly that, what
that,
you mean.
You know, because I've now corresponded with someone maybe 2 or 3 months after I've recorded an interview, and they may have done a dozen interviews since then. And I think this was something you were also saying, which I think was really good, was you said that the domestic workers that you were working with began to realise how editing a sound recording could change the message.
So I think you're exactly right, and that's the reason why, you know, you don't have to be a terrible, evil journalist or researcher to fall into that trap. It's an easy mistake to make, I suppose, if you're not co-editing or you're not working closely with that person. Researchers have their own interests and their own agendas and curiosities, genuine curiosities that lead them down paths that kind of are not really relevant or not really resonant with the people that they hear from. Part of this method of the co-editing especially was about holding myself accountable, I suppose, as a researcher to the things that they wanted to whatever that was. And it's been a really interesting process in a kind of meta-reflective way. Sitting for 14 hours with somebody gives you a really good insight into what they think is important. So it's not just about doing the work, it also helps me think about what their priorities are as activists or as people who've had certain experiences of labour abuse, let's say, or sometimes really positive experiences. But there's this kind of insight into what they want to get out of it, how they see themselves, how they identify, how they their perspectives on themselves really come through in those moments that I think they wouldn't at all in an ethnographic interview, let's say.
You've been listening to Talking Walking, brought to you by Rethinking Cities and the Museum of Walking. In this episode, you've heard from Ella Parry Davis. If you have any views on this interview or any walking issues, we would love to hear from you. Just follow the links on the Talking Walking website. We look forward to having you along for future episodes of Talking Walking. Written, recorded and produced by Andrew Stuck of Rethinking Cities Limited, our artwork is designed by Ian Martin of Art Art Graphics, and the music is composed by Simon Sanders of Easytronic.